And go.
Okay. My name is Paige Dean. I'm 19 years old. Today is May 28th, and I am speaking with Mr. Patrick Burke, who is my school principal. We are recording this interview in South Burlington, Vermont. So, why do you think that Vermont ranks high among the other states in terms of quality of education?
So, I think that there are some, I think a few reasons. One of the primary reasons is that Vermont has a really robust public education system, and for the most part, you know, with the exception of some small parochial schools and some kind of alternative schools and homeschooling, for the most part, Vermont's education culture is one that's centered around public schools. And so there really isn't a lot of independent schools or so-called private schools in Vermont. And so one of the benefits of that is that schools really do become the centerpieces of the communities mm-hmm. which they serve. And so I think that there's a real community value of education in Vermont that, has been the case since like the one room schoolhouse. Mm-hmm. And so it's that community value that gets placed on education that then also turns into, in some places, funding levels, especially in rural places, that really exceed what the national average would be. And so I think that, you know, in many respects, if you are going to fund public education as it should be, and in many places in Vermont that's the case, then you're going to see the kind of results that Vermont sees. And so that's the kind of sociological, I think, answer. I think if I were a researcher or some kind of like statistician or psychometrician, I would probably also attribute the success of Vermont schools to the fact that there is an overrepresentation of educated adults in Vermont already compared to the country. So what I mean by that is like more Vermont adults have high school diplomas than the whole country as a whole. More Vermont adults have bachelor's degrees than the whole country. More Vermont adults have advanced degrees beyond bachelor's. And so I think that there's some connection between the educational attainment of parents and the eventual educational attainment of their children. And so that's another reason why Vermont students, when compared to their peers, outperform them on the metrics that those rankings usually look at.
Right.
Next question?
Yeah. This kind of ties into the last one, yeah. But what is Vermont's perspective on education and how is that reflected in our education policy?
So the other thing that Vermont does in terms of, Vermont really has a value for community and the individual. And so I think that the way that that's reflected in our education policy is through what's commonly referred to as local control. So, fun fact, there are more school board members in Vermont than there are math teachers. And so, example hang on just one sec.
Sorry, quick question for you.
Yeah.
I'm trying to...
Hold on, let me... So, local control, it means that like every town in Vermont has their own like little school board. And I think that it's the closeness of the community to the actual children, to the actual school, that engenders this like this real a positive environment for young people. And so I think the education policy in Vermont is tilted in favor of children and students in a way, especially in rural areas, where there are significantly more challenges in terms of scale. You know what I mean? So I think that you would find that there are more so-called micro schools in Vermont than almost anywhere else, certainly in the Northeast. You know, and these would be schools that are graduating, you know, 10 seniors or 30, even 30 seniors is a really, you'd think is a really small class. But there are a high number of schools that are that small. And I think that the mechanism of local control is part of what perpetuates those community-based schools.
All right. So what do you think high school students around the country should learn in school but don't?
I think that answer changes for me all the time. But I think right now, and it's kind of like, it's one of those things where it's like, some high school, so my answer is like, what do I think like every high school student should learn? Mm-hmm. And right now, like only some do and some don't, right. You know what I mean? So that, to kind of reframe the question, because I don't want to make it sound like nobody learns this stuff. But I think that there's, I think right now in terms of like, I don't want to call them crises, but in terms of like issues that are significant within our country, I think one would be like the ability to be a critical thinker in a way that, you know, finds you a successful consumer of media or a successful consumer of information in a way that will not allow for you to be fooled or misled or subject to propaganda and whatnot in a way that would negatively affect the country or affect you as an individual. So I think there are skills there that that just being a citizen is going to require everyone has. And I think that's new and continuing to develop. So and then within that, I think there are pieces of our world that having citizens who understand them will make them live better lives. So like the first one is kind of a collective experience. Like if everyone understands how to be critical thinkers, then we're going to collectively lead better. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Or we're going to collectively be better as a community. But I also feel like there are mechanisms within democracy and mechanisms within capitalism that if people understand those on an individual level, their lives will be better. And those kind of mechanisms are around community engagement. Like how can I make a difference, you know, in my community, and what does that mean? You know, what does that mean in the 21st century? And then the other is how can I make a difference in my life? And some of that I would throw in things like financial literacy and, you know, the ability to understand, you know, on a base level, like how budgets work and how you know, how taxes work and, mm-hmm. and all of those kinds of like, you know, small e economic issues impact individuals. Ready?
Yeah. So what is your professional opinion on the rising cost of higher education and the student debt crisis?
So, I think that, so there, there, I have no doubt that there's that it's a crisis, and I think right now it's a crisis that's kind of going to hit us in two ways, and it's already hit us in one way, which is like you have all of these young people who have debt, and what does it mean for a young person who is, you know, graduating from college with, you know, let's say, you know, between $20,000 and $100,000 in debt. And so I'm going to come back to that in a second. And then the other question is just one of access in the first place, and how much is, you know, the specter of debt preventing people from even accessing higher ed to begin with. And so I want to talk about the first one first, which is just like people who are graduating with a lot of debt. And this is my big concern with that, is that, you know, as someone who hires people, you know, which, you know, I hire teachers, I hire paraeducators, assistant teachers, you know, all sorts of different roles within the school district that really, you know, in the grand scheme, you know, they pay fairly well, but they don't pay like amazingly well, especially as in people, if it's their first job, etc. So I worry that there are really good teachers out there in, particularly in, you know, so-called selective institutions, who are racking up debt, who would find themselves saying like, you know what I really would love to do is I'd really love to be a teacher, but I can't because I have so much debt that now I need to do something else so that I can make, you know.
People like choosing jobs for financial reasons instead of like passion or ability.
Correct. And so it's almost like, you know how people sometimes say like, oh, the cure for cancer could be out there, but if the person doesn't get an education, then they won't, you know. And I feel a little bit like that too with, you know, like the best teachers in the world, they could be out there, but if they're never going to go into the profession because they're saddled with so much debt, then that's, you know, that's going to bring out just a crisis in terms of like the human resource and the human capital that needs to go into the education field. And by the way, it's not just education, it's like social work is another area where, you know, in order to be a licensed social worker, you not only have to have a bachelor's, you have to have a master's degree, right? And in many states, you need to have a master's degree to be a teacher in public schools also. And so then you're looking at, you know, these folks have quite a bit of debt. And then you just Google starting salary for social workers. And it's like, wow, how is anybody doing this, you know? And even within that construct, it could be like, you know, I mean, I remember like I had debt when I graduated and I started working right in the education field. And, you know, I had to paint houses in the summer and I had to like be like a waiter, you know what I mean? And like make extra money and stuff like that. But I also, but that's not great either, because I think about it and it's like, you know, it's hard to be a good teacher. And it's really hard to be a good teacher when like you work all day and then you go, you know, wait tables at McGillicuddy's and then you get home and then you're supposed to, you know, do your corrections or plan for your next day. And so it doesn't really feel to me like, you know, that's a solution either, you know? So then you have people having, you know, two jobs and potentially not doing either one of them well. And newsflash, the teaching job is pretty important. Like, you know, like I really need, you know, people who are able to be, you know, highly competent and focused on the profession and focused on their students. And so I think it's significant and it's real. And, you know, in those two specific examples of what the problem is, maybe there's solutions too. So maybe, you know, part of the funding mechanisms that we come up with, you know, could have like a sliding scale in terms of like your eventual career path, you know what I mean? So if you're going into a field that's really lucrative, well then maybe, you know, you pay back 100% of the debt that you garnered while you were in college or post-grad. But maybe if you go into a field that like is more serves the public good and is less rewarding in terms of like salary and benefits, then maybe some of your loans are forgiven or are phased out, or you only pay back a certain portion. And those kinds of solutions are interesting. I mean, they don't necessarily keep costs down, which is kind of the other side of the solution, but at least in the short term, I think society would be potentially a stopgap to like the immediate crisis. And then, you know, the long-term solution is just really finding ways for, you know, higher ed to become more affordable for everyone. And, you know, I think there are places around the world that the U.S. could look to see, you know, places like Europe and even Canada, you know, where higher ed is much more easily accessed by everyone and mm-hmm. not just by, you know, people who have the ability to pay.
So what is your opinion on the recent school district murders in Vermont?
So generally speaking, I think they're good. And mm-hmm. You know, and this is going to run counter a little bit to what I was talking earlier mm-hmm. about some of the benefits right. of Vermont being some of those small governance structures. But I think that there's a real crisis right now. I think it was one thing when some of these small high schools had 100 kids per graduating class. You know, again, like I know high school, so I'm going to pick on high schools. And, you know, but because like 100 kids per graduating class, you could still have a couple APs. You could still have like... Right. like a shop class, you could still have industrial arts, you could still have a band, you know what I mean? You could still have a chorus, you know, but I think once you get down to 30 kids per class, 20 kids per class, then you're really looking at, you know, how much opportunity do these students really have? And if you are a young person who, you know, let's say you're really into chorus and you go to a school that has, you know, 15 to 20 students per grade, but you're probably not going to have a chorus, you know what I mean? Or if you do have a chorus, you're not going to have a band. And I just think that then, you know, we start running into really limited opportunities for young people in those communities. And so that's where, if especially at the high school level, you could kind of coalesce some of these smaller schools together. And, you know, what's the perfect size for a high school? That's probably something that communities that do merge have to decide together, you know, because like everybody kind of has a different opinion about that. I happen to think like we're about 900. I like our size mm-hmm. because I think it allows for us to offer really broad programming. Do I think 500 students in a high school is too small? I don't know, maybe not. You know, that might be an okay size also. But I think once you start getting under, you know, 400, under 300 students, it really starts to impact the opportunities that those students have. So I am in favor of the mergers because I think they're a way to get communities working together, so eventually the opportunities for students will increase. You know, in the younger grades, I don't feel as strongly about that, you know, like kindergarten through fourth grade, I don't really have a problem with some of those really small schools for kids that are that big or that little, I should say, you know, because it's like, hey, you know, you don't really want to put the second grader on the bus for 2 hours,
yeah.
You know what I mean? Whereas, you know, we have students who go to this school who live in Alberg and North Hero and Isle of Mott, and, you know, it takes them an hour and 20 minutes each way mm-hmm. to get here, you know, but at least when they get here, it's like, they have, you know, all these great opportunities in terms of classes and co-curriculars, et cetera.
So does the South Burlington School District feel the PLP system of proficiencies is off to a good start?
So it's kind of interesting that PLPs and proficiencies get put together so often, like just the fact that they're together in this one question is interesting, because fun fact, they actually came about by way of separate pieces of both are mandates,
mm-hmm.
but they came separate. You know what I mean? So the State Board of Education, which has the authority of making rules which have the power of law. So they're not the legislature, but they mm-hmm. have they can make rules that have the power of law, which is kind of interesting. They put in proficiency-based graduation requirements. And kind of at the same time, the legislature put in what was called flexible pathways provision, and that included the PLPs. So since there were these two mandates happening at the same time, and they were kind of rolled out at the same time,
people connected
a lot of people connect them. And actually, they kind of work pretty well together. Yeah. So it's not like, we're not connecting, you know, two completely disparate concepts. But my answer is going to be separate, because okay. I think that the idea of proficiency-based learning, and now I'm just talking about in South Burlington, I think it's the best thing we've done in the 20 years I've been here, in terms of just really putting learning at the center of everything we talk about, in terms of professional development, et cetera. And let me tell you, so the other thing that I think it does is I think it really guarantees that when students graduate from South Burlington High School, for example, that they are prepared for whatever they're going to do next. Whereas under the old system, I think there was a little bit more of like, I hope that they're prepared for what they do next. Because, you know, students would, for example, I mean, the easiest example I always talk about is, you know, I remember, you know, back, well, like you're the last class to graduate without proficiencies. Mm-hmm. So let's pretend I'm in your graduating class and I'm sitting with my guidance counselor at the end of sophomore year and I'm trying to decide what courses I'm going to pick senior year. So, you know, you need two more years of English, right? So you're at the end of your sophomore year, you're in your sophomore exhibition, and you decide that you really don't like writing. And everybody in the room decides that you're actually not that great at it and you need a little more work in that. So you're like, yep, that's what I'm going to do. I need more work in writing. You know what you're going to take for English? You're going to take public speaking. No, you're not going to take writing because writing's hard and you're not good at it. Mm-hmm. You're going to take public speaking. You're going to take engaging with literature. You'll take contemporary issues. And senior year, maybe you'll take, British literature. I've done nothing to improve my writing on a micro level. You know what I mean? Now, if the graduation requirement wasn't this like global 4 years of English, it was more like, no, you need to be an effective communicator in writing. You need to be an effective communicator mm-hmm. in speaking. You need to be effective. You know what I mean? That's what now we have. Now I'm same situation and I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, okay, I am going to have to show that I am proficient in writing. How am I going to do that? Well, I could take, you know, AP Lang, but I'm already not, that might be a little hard, you know what I mean? Because I'm already, so I know, I'll take grammar and editing. Grammar and editing would be perfect. Or advanced comp. That would be perfect for me, because then I will have, you know, McFadden or whomever, like, helping me become a competent writer, help proficient writer, if you will. And then, you know, then I can take public speaking, because I really want to, you know, then I can take, you know, engaging with literature, because I really do love to read. You know what I mean? So, but the escape of avoiding what you're not good at, mm-hmm. proficiencies safeguards against that, because they're just a little bit more discreet than our old graduation requirements. So I think it's a good thing. And then the question is, you know, how do you determine proficiency, and what do we do when students aren't, and how can we create supports for students who you know, need to get there? And so that's what we're kind of learning right now is, you know, I've got all these juniors. When junior year's over, I'm gonna have to sit there and look at, all right, I got all these juniors who have not met graduation requirements. How am I gonna get them there? Mm-hmm. You know, whereas right now, I mean, you probably know this because I'm certain it was true for you. If it wasn't for English and PWA, you had met all of our graduation requirements. I mean, yeah. Maybe you needed a PE, but probably not. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So like, if it wasn't for English and PWA, you were almost done. You know, so that's got to be true under the proficiency model also. And then what do we do for those students for whom that's not true? You know, and how are we going to make sure that they get the support that they need so that they're ready? You know, so that I'm not at graduation going like, well, that kid's graduating, but, you know, hope they're okay, mm-hmm. you know. So it's a little bit more of a guarantee. Now, PLPs, It's my separate, my second answer. I haven't met too many students who would, even like awesome students like yourself, like you know, when we talk about PLPs, I get a lot of like, you know, and so I would like to really kind of understand why is it that there's what I would like positively frame as universal frustration mm-hmm. with the PLP process. Like what is it that makes it frustrating for students? You know what I mean? Because for the most part, students, especially around here, like if something is worth it, even if it's hard, they'll engage. You know what I mean? If they see the point in it. And I really feel like we have to take a step back and try to understand why is it that PLPs have no traction or very little traction within students' lives, you know what I mean? Whereas I think they were designed or people were imagining that they were going to really be positive things for students. I don't know that that's exactly what's going on. So I think in terms of off to a good start, I think we're off to a good start with proficiencies. Mm-hmm. With PLPs, I think, you know, we really need to take a good look at, you know, keeping what's working and maybe shifting things around a little bit to make it something that's more valuable to the students.
Right. So what types of funding or what changes would you most like to see at the high school or in the district?
Okay, so this is going to run a little bit in conflict with it in a nuanced way with your next question about vouchers, but I think that high school students should be able to easily take courses at other schools if their school doesn't have the course that they want to take. And so in order for that to happen, there needs to be some portability of funding with the students. So like, you know, right now, for example, if you really wanted to take Chinese, mm-hmm. we don't have Chinese at SPHS, but Burlington does. And you know, if you came to me early in the year, I could be like, well, I'll make a phone call, and I'd call the principal at Burlington. He's kind of a friend of mine. I'll be like, no, can you help me out? I got this girl. You got any room in a Chinese class? And he'd be like, yeah. And he'd say, actually, you know, I have another student, and they're really interested in German, and we don't have German. And so, like, we might just work this out. Mm-hmm. But there's no, like, apparatus for that. There's right. no mechanism for that. It's just, like,
no centralized program.
Nothing. So. Right. And it's just... And really, what would memorialize the centralized program would be... If you could disaggregate, like there's an amount of money that the school gets per student in Vermont. And if you could take that money and split it between different schools or different, you know, based on what the students want to do, I think that would be really beneficial. So like, for example, currently you can do that if you go to a tech center. So for the SBHS students who go to a tech center, money flows to SBHS and then flows out to the tech center. I think it would be cool if students could do that almost in any program that may exist at a neighboring school that doesn't exist at their school. You know, so whatever. Winooski doesn't have a jazz band. Well, if there's a trumpet player at Winooski who really wants to be in a jazz band, we have a chair for him, you know what I mean? And Mr. Grippa would love to teach that student. So that student comes with resources that, and when my jazz band gets small, or when somebody says to me, you know, you only have 12 kids in your jazz band, that's a lot of money you're paying Grippa to just teach 12 kids. It's like, oh no, actually I have 27 because I have, you know, 4 Winooski kids and 3 Colchester kids. And, you know, so that kind of flexibility, I think would really, flexible funding would really help kids in Vermont. And I think it would really help rural kids, especially, because you know that story I was telling before, you know, like, so if a kid lives in Marshfield and goes to Twinfield High School, and which is a pretty small school, but it's also only 20 miles away from U32, which is a pretty big school that has a lot of really robust programming, and that students took AP Calculus when they were a junior. It's like, now they're a senior, they can probably get to U32 no problem. You know what I mean? So like, let them go to U32. And you know, one of the solutions now is like, oh, well, they can take an online class. Mm. But I just feel like it should be or. Like, okay, fine, take an online class. Or you should be able to go to U32 and you should have the money go with you. You know, not all your money, but a percentage of it. So are you ready to talk more about vouchers?
Yes.
All right. So there, like, I wouldn't lay down in front of a bulldozer to keep vouchers coming into Vermont's system unless, but my absolute non-negotiable is that they have to be public school vouchers. So like, I mean that like, you know, so I mean that particularly with respect to separation of church and state. So I really think that, and you know, I actually went to a parochial school. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm certainly not biased against religiously right. affiliated schools, but I do not think that public dollars should fund religious schools. And so I feel strongly about that, you know, that if money is being raised by a community to educate their young people, then that money should be should go into a public schools. And so some of what, you know, DeVos proposes runs counter to that. To the extent that her voucher proposals allow for flexible funding within public schools, and there's always some qualifiers with respect to that, you know, to make sure that there's equity. I don't have a negative reaction. Too negative, anyway.
Okay. So, what can we do from an educational perspective to encourage young Vermonters to stay in state?
Well, I think loan forgiveness is something that I already talked about in terms of, you know, for young people who go out of state and you know, maybe make it attractive for folks to come back. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sure, I'm not going to make as much as I would if I stayed in Boston or New York City, but I'm also not going to have to pay back as much of my loans, and I'm going to breathe clean air, you know? So I would look for those kind of incentive programs to bring students back. And also, I think that University of Vermont really needs to, and the Vermont State Colleges are doing a better job at this, but I think we really need to take a look at just how much it costs to go to UVM, you know? And I think if you're somebody who grows up in Vermont and goes to UVM, you're likely to stay in Vermont. And it's not like the whole bring you back thing. It's like you never left. And so, you know, I get concerned when I hear about students who want to go to UVM, get accepted to UVM, but are going to school in upstate New York because it's cheaper. You know, because I worry, are we going to be able to get them back? So I think there are some challenges in terms of the straight up cost of UVM.
All right.
Ready?
Yes. What do you think Vermont can do to prepare our students to be competitive in a global job market?
You know, I think it goes back to what I was talking about it in terms of people being critical thinkers and adept at consuming information in a way that is going to benefit themselves, their employer, and their community. Because and then within that, it's like, yeah, I think there are some fields that Vermont could do would be well served to invest in, mm-hmm. like, you know, what like broadband access. Like it's rapidly getting to the point in, it's rapidly getting to the point in the world where people could actually run a business. All they need is like high speed internet and an airport, mm-hmm. you know. And I think that, you know, as infrastructure becomes less and less a part of what it means to be to run a successful enterprise, I think Vermont could really be in a good spot, you know, where it's like, oh yeah, it's awesome. Like, you know, I do this, you know, banking, or I work for this marketing company, or I, you know, I help on a sales team. I live in Vermont, the company's in California, or, you know, the mm-hmm. company's in Chicago. And, you know, sure, I got to go to Chicago, you know, every other month for 3 days. That's why I'm happy that I live near the airport, you know, where I can easily get there and back. But most of the time I'm home, I've got my really, you know, high speed internet access, and I can Skype into meetings, and I'm one of the best players on the team on the sales team, you know, for whatever. You know, whatever company there is. And I think Vermonters, or the kind of culture in Vermont, has always been one that really values hard work. And so, you know, when you talk to people who hire, and when you talk to people, like, that's what they really need the most. And I think we have that. And so to, you know, and so hopefully our students, like what our students need is like an understanding of that. And that's like, you got to be a little self-directed. You have to be adept at being a critical thinker. You know, I mean, sometimes you think like, oh, I'm going to work from home. And then it's like, oh, I sat around and drank coffee mm-hmm. and ate, you know, cereal until 11 a.m. It's like, well, that's not really going to work out, you know. So making sure that our students have, you know, the ability to be self-directed, or to do a good job when it's not like somebody looking over their shoulder all the time. I think those are important skills for our students to have to be successful in a global market.
Great.
Sound good?
Yeah.
All right. That's our last recording. So we're gonna be done now. Are you sure you're finished recording? Yeah.